This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Can you explain the process of seeing the metaphor behind what people say?
Yeah. The first thing to recognize is the only reason we developed language was to communicate what we feel. So what most people don't recognize is when they're having a conversation, they're even if they're totally detached, they may not be emotionally and intellectually aware that they're still trying to communicate their feelings. And so what they'll use are descriptors and metaphors. And that's what I'm always listening to, especially with a client or in any conversation. I'm looking for descriptors and metaphors because those will tell me the underlying emotional condition that they're trying to get across, even if they're not aware of it. Now, depending on the level of connection and comfort and trust and relationship development, you know, with someone like Mike, you know, my old counselor, we're now best friends, or you, you know, we hear a descriptor or a metaphor, we could have a conversation about it. There's safety and trust. But if I'm at a cocktail party, you know, I'm going to have boundaries around that. You know, I will sit there and go, huh, isn't that interesting? They just told me their whole life story is they were talking about badminton, but they don't, you know, there isn't the relationship development to have that discussion. So, you know, let me see if I can think of some examples to demonstrate that. You know, the one that I use all the time is when I discovered how this part works. It's what I call, basically nine mechanisms to denial. And I feel like I've figured out a 10th one, what I call indirect denial. And this is where the descriptor and metaphor comes in. And I figured that out when I was driving, and I've told the story 1,000 times, but my biggest, whenever we, you know, here's what people need to recognize. Whenever we judge, blame, hate, criticize anyone, any person, place, or thing, while it might be true that they're doing that, the only reason we see it in them is because it's operating in us as well. We either do the exact same thing directly. So, you know, I always say an example of direct denial would be, I can't stand men who wear bright colored suits and pocket squares and colorful socks. They're all such peacocks. And, you know, so obviously I'd be talking about myself because that's pretty much all I ever wear. That one, even though many people don't see that in themselves, most people can identify that. But indirect is what gets people confused. They're like, but I don't do what I'm complaining about, whether they're, you know, a narcissist or, you know, bad relationship, a boss, coworker, whatever it is. They're like, yeah, but I don't do that. Well, when I figured out what I call indirect denial, it was, I was at a stoplight getting ready to turn left. I'm in the left-hand turn lane. There's a big truck in front of me and he's waiting. Their car's coming this way and he's waiting for them to turn. Well, it's a 3-lane road. The rules of the road are, you know, that person turning right, coming the other direction and turning right, they just stay in their lane. We both turn at the same time. We just stay in our lanes. Well, the guy in the truck wouldn't turn, and I'm screaming at him. And, you know, I'm judging him with lots of swear words. And, you know, finally I was like, you know, I just was lamenting how stupid he was. And I was like, God, I hate stupid drivers. And I'm like, Kenny, this is about you. Because remember, everything out of our mouth is to try and explain what we're feeling emotionally. And so I paused. I'm like, you know, but I'm judging and criticizing. So this is about me, but I don't drive like that. I go. And if that person turning right veers into me, I honk. Like, I'm like, you know, you may not know the rules of the road, but I do. And I'm not going to control you, but I'm going to drive, you know, I'm not going to stop for you. And further, you're, you know, that would be codependent of me to enable your, you don't know these concepts, but it's not my job. It would be enabling for me to allow you to live dysfunctionally. And I don't, it goes against my morals and values to enable people and their dysfunction. And so I just, you know, I turn. And if they get mad, that's fine. They can do that. I don't respond back. So at any rate, the truck in front of me wouldn't turn. I paused and I'm like, okay, this is about me, but I don't do that. And I ask myself, I go through the three emotional mastery questions. What am I feeling? Where in my body do I feel it? What's my first memory of having this feeling? Well, what am I feeling? You know, just a myriad, you know, my specificity around my emotional language was about 20 different feelings. Where in my body do I feel it? Mostly in my stomach. What's my first memory? Well, then I got flooded with memories of childhood, of instances where my father, you know, would roll his eyes or wouldn't answer a question. You know, he sent, like, asking him for help with math homework. And he was an engineer and he knew all these shortcuts. And once math got into theory, I couldn't process it. Also, the repeated exposure to my dad rolling his eyes, huffing and puffing that I didn't have an answer sent me into fight or flight. And so even if I could figure it out, when you're in fight or flight, the blood doesn't come to the front part of your brain. So I just shut off. And many other instances. And so ultimately, what was I feeling? Stupid. That, like, I just get chills right now. Like, that was the first understanding of, because remember what I said, I hate stupid drivers. There's the descriptor I'm using, stupid. Whoa, stupid refers to me. I've always felt stupid. And then I immediately got hit with, I've had two failed marriages, multiple addictions. In one of those marriages, I was physically and verbally abused. Went through a horrific child custody battle. She alienated the kids from me. I've gone bankrupt fighting for my kids. I played two professional sports. I see now I never wanted to play either of them. And I spent 3 days contemplating taking my life. So, look, and, you know, it could go on and on. So, in other words, I have made a myriad of stupid decisions in my life. Like, I might literally be the dumbest person I've ever met. Now, is that true? No, but it is also true. Like, it's okay that at times we're all stupid. So I was realizing his stupidity or their stupidity is a lack of ownership for how I haven't faced my trauma around feeling stupid. The fear I have, because now I'm talking about the worst day cycle, trauma, fear, shame, and denial. The trauma I experienced that sent the message directly and indirectly, I was stupid as a child, which sent me into fear, which created the shame persona that then became denial. I can't admit I'm stupid, so I'm going to project it onto you that you're so stupid. Right? So now I'm projecting now we get into the next process I developed, the authentic self cycle, truth, responsibility, healing, and forgiveness. So I got into truth. Wow, I'm stupid. Like, we're all stupid at times. I'm very stupid. Responsibility, it's up to me to take ownership of that truth, put a plan in place, which is the healing of the worst day cycle. That's step three, healing of the authentic self cycle. And step four, forgiveness. Now that I'm into truth of how stupid I felt my whole life, I can work truth, responsibility, healing, and forgiveness, turn it back on myself and go, well, no wonder I'm so stupid. Society's never taught us about emotional mastery. Society's never taught us about the worst day cycle, the authentic self cycle, none of this stuff. I was just doing the best I could with where I was. Yes, I'm stupid, and I'm also not stupid. I'm both. Well, I can forgive myself. I was doing the best I could with the information I had at the time. if my dad had known that his behavior played a part in me choosing a persona that felt I was stupid, he could have parented different. So it's, if society, like society is part of it, my parents are, but there's all this stuff that's way out of my control. Well, now I can forgive both my father and myself. Well, that frees me from, okay, now I've dealt with how stupid, the descriptor of stupid is actually an open door into me healing my worst day cycle and adopting the authentic self cycle so I can reclaim myself. All right. So I've got that part handled. Well, hate is the same thing. I hate myself for the lack of all of that. So the same logic and process applies to the that descriptor of hate and judgment. You use the exact same process. Now, where's the metaphor? Drive. Do you see what the metaphor is? I hate stupid drivers. What's the how is that metaphorically about me? Do you see what I just described? I couldn't drive my own life. Addictions, divorces, bankruptcy, false careers, contemplating taking my life. That's indirect denial. That's metaphor. So whenever we are talking about anything, whenever we're describing anything, and we use metaphorical language, which is, you know, like that, I hate stupid drivers. And it could be about a judgment about somebody else. It could just be an idle conversation of, that feels like just like being on a roller coaster. Okay, what's the metaphor of the roller coaster? Has your life gone like this? You know, what language are you using metaphorically to speak back to yourself? How you're in the worst day cycle of trauma, fear, shame, and denial. And you're using that metaphor to try and trigger, if you develop emotional mastery, choose to learn about it, and pursue the authentic self cycle of truth, responsibility, healing, and forgiveness, you're going to see that in virtually every sentence out of your mouth, you think you're talking to the other person, you're just talking to yourself. And even in a relationship, and you're going, you don't support me, right? Or you treat me like a dog, huh? Where am I barking up the wrong tree? Oh, maybe dating you was barking up the wrong, but that's how you do it. But you have to learn a lot of stuff to be proficient at it. But that's the basic idea of how descriptors and metaphors are all about us.
So it seems that descriptors and metaphors have to do with the denial topic in regards to how we choose to project as well. When we, instead of diving into emotional mastery in our inner world, we maybe go towards anger, use anger as a projectile weapon, and then disperse it to those around us. Whoever, it seems like we even have the, like this awareness of, oh, this person's willing to take my anger here. Carry my shame, carry my guilt, you know.
Blame is just shame. It's transferred shame. Whenever I blame you, as I like to say, a blame shifter is a shame shifter. Mm-hmm. And it usually gets expressed in anger, because as we talked about before, anger is a cover for fear, which covers sadness. So underneath the anger, I'm tremendously sad at how I haven't dealt with my worst day cycle through the use of the authentic self cycle and developing emotional mastery. And so because I don't have the skill, I am caught in Freud's always classified denial as a defense mechanism. I'm proposing that while that's true, it's a limited definition of denial. It's actually, it starts as a defense mechanism because we don't have the emotional mastery capability to process what's happening. It then doubles back and attacks us. And so the anger destroys us. The displacement of and projection and all the other different denial mechanisms, by not addressing the worst day cycle, we are then re-victimizing ourselves.
Are you then saying this becomes an act of self-sabotage without being aware of it?
Exactly. It's almost the worst. Almost everybody is self-victimizing in almost every one of their pursuits. But because we don't teach these concepts, they're not aware of it. They may recognize, oh, that choice I went against myself, but that's as close as they get to it. They don't see that there's so much going on. And that, you know, they're just reliving. They were experienced trauma as a childhood. And what people don't realize is even your father rolling your eyes at you is a traumatic experience. It sends the message, I am of no value and no worth. Plus, observing your parents' dysfunctions is traumatic because we learn emotions from three things. We're not born with emotions. They are learned constructs. We learn them from the childhood environment, our parents, caregivers, the way they simulated that emotional moment, whether it was anger, sadness, whatever. There was a simulation of this is what that emotion looks like, which develops a concept, and then it becomes defined. This, when I feel sad, it means those three things have happened. We learn that from observing them. Then the culture we're in, look at the difference in definitions around racism and all these different topics from 30 years ago. So now we're supposed to feel emotionally different than we used to. And so that plays a part. And the third thing that creates our emotions is the state of our body: hungry, angry, lonely, tired. You know, what's going on in our body, what's called our affect, our interoceptive network. It's constantly regulating itself. And so if one part gets deprived, that can spark an emotion that doesn't even have to do with childhood or society. But those three things coalesce together to give us our definitions. Well, since we're so massively underdeveloped emotionally, and most people don't even know that when you're having an adult emotion, you're not present. That's all bad. You learned that in the first 7 years of life, when you're in a theta brainwave state, which is the exact same as hypnosis. This is why everyone thinks their childhood was perfect, because when all the trauma happened, you weren't even cognitively awake, and it became normalized. And you're like, childhood was fine. Well, that's because all the trauma happened. You developed false personas and adaptations before you were consciously aware and started living those out. So you think you're in your authenticity, you're not. And so all of this, so again, going back, like, look at all the things you have to uncover to really find your authentic self. Well, that's right. Why you need to learn about the four stages of the worst day cycle, the authentic self cycle, and emotional mastery. And then you can understand how descriptor and metaphor and all of these things in anger and displacement that you brought up, how they're all way back here. And you get to decide. What you'll find out is most of the things you are living by, your morals and values, your needs and wants, your negotiables and non-negotiables, aren't even yours. They're not truth to you. They're adaptations that you swallowed as a survival mechanism in childhood. And that, to live in your authentic self, you have to break all of that down and rediscover yourself.
Meaning that most of the things that people show up as an adult in their 20s and their 30s and beyond thinking, oh, this is who I am, this is my personality, quote unquote, I'm just this way, you know, accept me as I am kind of attitude as well sometimes. These are all things, what you're saying, if I'm correct, is that these are all things that are conditioned, created as patterns, habits, so to say, hammered into the nervous system and the emotional memory of the body and the brain again and again and again until you don't even notice these things. You know, they're just automatic impulses at one point.
Yeah. Our brain, Julian James discovered that a long time ago, that 95 to 99% of our adult life, we're just reliving the subconscious patterns of childhood. Almost never are we present as an adult, even though we think we are. They're all adaptations. It doesn't make us bad. Our brain is a repetitive machine because it takes so much energy for our brain to work, usually about 30% of our total dietary budget to run our brain. Your 30% of whatever you intake food-wise goes to run your brain. So it has a great mechanism to save energy. It repeats what it's already done, even if it's destructive. It doesn't know right from wrong. All it cares about is, have I performed this before or not? If I perform it, run the program so I can rest. So many people, when they hear me, they immediately tune me out because their brain's going, no, too much work. Nope, we don't have the body budget for that. We're just going to denial. Boom, the wall comes up. And that's all. That's what they had to do in childhood. That's a learned program. Because wait a minute, I can't fight with my parents. What if, you know? Because now what he's saying is, oh my God, my view of the world isn't correct. Well, that's what I heard from my parents. So, oh my God, Kenny's my, you know, they start seeing me as their parent. Wall. Their brain just immediately.
It's funny that you say this. I've experienced recently communication with some people where I could tell they're not listening. They say they're listening, but I'm like, it's now been weeks where, yeah, my body awareness and connection with myself now is so strong that I'm really certain and aware of when they're not really present with me in the moment. So when they keep saying it, and they sometimes even try to reassure me, no, I'm listening to you, and they mirror what I say with standard techniques of mirroring, you know, what even can be taught in business school, something like that, to reassure someone I am listening actively. But emotionally, their tonality reveals, their eye contact reveals they're not really connected to what I'm saying. And this is like from the opposite perspective of what you've been mentioning. I've just been noticing how it's sort of like when you try to speak to this person that is in that moment of emotional disconnection, dissociation, there's like this invisible shield that's like deflecting everything I'm saying. Now, of course, this can happen in two ways. One, when somebody's being abusive towards a person and somebody's holding a boundary, but the other way around as well, when somebody's being healthy towards a person that is used to abusive language and they're not willing or ready to receive inner growth, meaning even love. Like, for example, he's saying, hey, would you be willing to ask for your wants and needs more proactively? You know, if you experience this frustration around this aspect, it could be a business thing, a job thing. Would you be willing to just bring this this thing up that's coming up for you? Maybe you want things done differently. Maybe this doesn't work for you anymore. Bring it up as early as you think about it. Don't bring it up a month later if you can. Like, because yes, we can do something about it now, but we could do something about it earlier on. That's just one example where what I've seen is sometimes if the trauma around this person expressing wants and needs hasn't been addressed, even being asked to express their wants and needs in a healthy way would be something of a resistance. There would be a resistance like, no, you should have just known what I read my mind and you know, and knowing what I expected out of you without me even me telling you.
But is that connected to you? Let me see if I hear you right. What I think I hear you describing are two potentialities. The first one might be, I'm making this up because I'm not clear. I want to see if I'm clear. So I'm trying mm-hmm. to get information. What I think I'm hearing is in the first instance, in both instances, they're hearing you and listening, but they're not agreeing with your view, your reality on what it is you're saying. And so they're able to mirror back and say things, but they're not buying in. There's no buy-in. And so therefore, the emotional disconnect is, they don't share the same reality. And then the second thing is, because they comes out of the first, because there's not the emotional buy-in of, wow, what he's saying is true. You know, take what I just said about denial and everything. Wow, what he's saying is true. Wow, that's, you know, because they don't buy into that, They also then don't express their reality, their needs and wants. They just shut down and hide behind them. No, I agree with you. But there's no real agreement because all of those things are going under the surface, which I guess would lead to the third thing. And that's because of the underlying trauma. I can't express myself. Childhood comes up, all of these things of it's not safe for me to disagree or share my reality. So am I hearing you correctly? It's kind of those three things that you're observing?
Yes. And what I'm emphasizing here, and I would appreciate more elaboration on this, is that you definitely hit us some powerful concepts around being the one that's projecting, the one that's blaming, shaming, criticizing. But what about the person that is doing the work, is doing the growth, and is on the receiving end of that? You know, how do they then manage somebody that's going through that in the healthiest way possible, no matter what the
outcome? Receiving somebody who's not accepting your reality, but then won't tell you what the reality is?
Exactly. This person who's receiving the blame, receiving the criticism, receiving. So you see the opposite side of the chair, you know what I mean, of the table, so to say?
So if somebody was blaming me and I had a different reality, how would I respond? Is that your question?
Yes, basically how would you respond, but also in relation to everything you've discussed around denial and metaphors?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I think I understand your question. Most people, unless they paid me and hired me, or they are a religious follower of me, tune me out. I know in a public situation, I don't bring up any of this stuff because I just watch that glaze come over. And so even when somebody asks me and I start to see the glaze come over, I end the conversation. I end discussing that part of the I move it on to something else. I don't participate in it. And that goes for all levels of relationship, from very superficial to kind of in the middle. The only person I know that I can always go there and always be heard and is Mike. But Mike even might be like, look, I can't be present today. I want to listen. He'll tell me. And he's like, I'll try, keep going. I'll try and tune in as much as I can, but I'm going to be spotty. And like, that's the only person who's safe enough, who may disagree, but I won't see that he doesn't give me that emotional reaction of, I don't like you, or I don't like what you're saying.
Yeah,
he's there. Like that level of connection, very few people on this planet, like the level of emotional mastery that it requires to sit contained, hearing somebody say something you totally disagree with, and just be in total joy because you're in their presence. Man, that's what makes Mike and our relationship so precious, because that's what we give to each other. That level of connection, this planet doesn't, they don't even know what that looks like. So when I don't have that, I protect, I'm only responsible for me. And so I am in control of my internal boundary. And so when I recognize somebody's reality is different, they don't want to hear it, and they don't know how to protect themselves. And
without wanting to control you.
Exactly. Yeah. But they're, I respectfully take care of us both. Because if I notice it in you, I don't want to be an abuser. And so even though you're not saying it, I won't keep going. And because I have respect for the plight you're in and where you are in your journey of being able to take care of yourself. And if you can't do it, it's not my responsibility.
Right.
But I will do that because it matters to me. I'm meeting my need and want, which is all I can control. I don't like to keep going in those situations.
So each situation is different, as you've said. So if it's with Mike, it's one way. If it's with a client, if it's with a stranger, like I definitely treat my, for example, business partner different than I would treat a friend or a girlfriend or my parent, right? It's different with each person, or you, right? Different boundaries for different people and different safety levels with certain aspects of conversation.
Because yeah. I'll be in a cocktail party or, you know, a group of people or out on a date and somebody will bring up their opinion about something, you know, about the way they were treated or something. I'm like, oh my God, that's so codependent or whatever. And I don't open that door. Yeah. I'm just like, huh, so what'd you do about that?
So that's the cocktail party, but there's one that I see, for example, where it could be your marriage or a business relationship that's like a partnership or anything like that, where I do see calling someone forward to grow would be healthy. Like, for example, it could be in either of those situations where person A is blaming, shaming, criticizing person B, and person B is like, hey, we got into this marriage or business partnership because, not because we're both going to be perfect, but because we're going to show up the best we can. This is what I need and want from you for us to head in that direction. And I know you have needs and wants for me, so I want to hear them too. But I'm voicing, you know, person B to A, I'm voicing that. And then person A can either say, okay, that works for me, or that doesn't work for me, right? And then say, I am willing to meet those wants and needs, or we need to negotiate on that, or I'm not willing, which I believe fine. We all have autonomy as adults, right? But this is a scenario in which I also had in mind, because yes, with some people, it is like the cocktail party that you mentioned, where it's like, no, like complete boundaries, like it's their responsibility. We don't even need to say a word. We just move on to the next topic. With other people, it's like, technically, I can't, this is not, it wouldn't be healthiest to move on to the next topic and shove this thing under the rug. This needs to be addressed as soon as possible, discussed, and we need to reach a mutual agreement on where we're going to move from here. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. You're separating it from a conversation with a stranger or casual acquaintance to somebody you have a deeper relationship, you know, whether business or personal. Well, at that point, I switch. Then, you know, I use the confrontation model I teach. And, you know, there's a way to have those conversations. And the biggest mistake people make when it comes to confrontation is they take the other person's inventory, which is all about, well, you said this, you did this, your face means that. They observe things in the other person, whether it's their words, their actions, their behavior, whatever it may be. They go inside, they make an assumption on what it means, it becomes their truth, and then they tell the other person, you know, my reality is right about what you're doing. Yours is wrong. Right. Well, that's taking somebody's inventory. That is severe codependence. You see it everywhere. Everyone's telling them, well, that, you know, I won't give examples. We all know what that looks like.